All right, I'm going to go ahead and get started because I've got a lot I want to cover today and not too much time. My name is Rich Felker. I'm the primary author and maintainer of MuscleLibC, which we'll be talking a little bit about today. And my talk today is going to be about libraries, in particular C libraries, because, well, that's what I work with. And probably more importantly, the libraries written in C and for programs written in C are what's at the core of Linux systems and sort of the root of the library stack and the software stack that we use. So Linux as a platform has a real crisis in the quality of its libraries. And I say that both in terms of code quality and of quality as libraries. Code quality I'm not going to spend a lot of time on today because that's something everyone's covered in plenty of other ways. But understanding the quality of a library as a library is something that is really missing in the discussion of libraries on Linux. So just to give a little bit of background, my interest in this whole topic sort of started in 2005 with this crazy idea I had. I said, let's go ahead and replace glibc with something different. And we'll see later in this talk, you know, what's come of that, the directions that went in. But I want to start off with what the initial frustrations were that sort of motivated that, because that brings us into what sort of problems we have with the quality of libraries on Linux right now. So my first thought was bloat. You know, everyone who starts looking at Linux says, wow, this is so bloated. What happened? How can we get the system smaller, simpler, faster, and all that? But it turned out that that was just a symptom of other problems when I started looking into things. And the root cause was complexity. Things getting way too complex. And the bigger symptom than bloated that comes out of that is a lack of correctness, a lack of robustness. You have problems where you can't handle failures because your system's too complex. And it turned out this wasn't just a problem in glibc, but in all sorts of libraries that are used throughout Linux programs. So we're going to look a little bit at both today. At its core, my talk today is sort of a persuasive talk. I hope to convince you of a couple things. And the first is,
bring it up to full screen.
Let's see if that helps.
Bring to the right.
I've got a better idea. There, much better. All right, the first is that having a solid library foundation actually matters. But we have a long way to go to get there, but there is hope. And this is sort of an exciting area to get involved in stuff. In developing MuscleLibC, I've built up a community that's very interested in this topic, and we're making progress. It's something fun to be involved in, so that's what I sort of hope to share in the later part of this talk. Now a little bit about motivations. Why would you care, whether we've got problems with library quality? Well, one thing is we'd like to improve the experience of Linux on the desktop. And I want to give a little bit of a motivation or anecdote for this. A project I was working on a couple years ago, I had someone deliver to me a scanned image of a piece of art about this large at 600 dpi. And I had it saved in a directory on one of my devices. I think it was on a USB device or something. I plugged it in, navigated to it. I was using XFCE at the time. And as soon as I navigated to this directory, the whole system became unusable. What happened? Well, it was trying to make a thumbnail for this file that probably was going to take half a gigabyte to store in memory. And my computer didn't have that at the time. So this, to me, that was an unacceptable user experience. That shouldn't happen to users. And my experience is that it doesn't happen on Windows, so it was kind of embarrassing that this happened on Linux. Now, we could have solved problems like that if every process had some kind of resource limits on it, if we were controlling the amount of memory individual processes could use. If the file manager had a resource limit that said, you can't go over 50 megs, or you can't go over 100 megs. But unfortunately, we have a lot of problems that if we put those resource limits in place, we would just have software start crashing all over the place. And that goes back to what we're going to talk about in just a little bit. Second, laying the groundwork for a native mobile ecosystem. And what I mean here is, you know, the desktop is on its way out, or at least, you know, it's only going to be people like us, graphics designers, people with specialized uses using desktops. You know, in a few years, 99% of computer use is going to be mobile devices, tablets, phones, things like that. And these have a lot of different requirements from desktop. Right now, you know, we're all, I think, you know, pretty proud to say, you know, wow, look how Linux has made it. You know, every Android device is using Linux. But I'm not satisfied with that. You know, I say, you know, Android is still a fairly proprietary environment. It's in many ways not as good as its competitor iOS. I'm not an Apple fan by any means.
I'm going to yell it out. Bionic is crap.
All right. We'll get to that. But yeah, the main situation here is, you know, I want something that's better, and I want something that free and open source software developers are in control of and, you know, setting the direction of, rather than just following Google's lead and being second best. And to do this, we're going to need a lot of improvement, because you don't want your dialer app and your phone crashing. You don't want your phone, you know, bogging down and swapping while you're trying to talk to someone. And then third, becoming competitive in hard real-time and embedded markets. And that, you know, Linux has made some progress there, but, you know, I'm thinking of things, you know, like in the long term, medical equipment or automotive control, things like that. And no one would really think about putting lots of the software in places like that right now because it's not robust enough. So I want to introduce the concept of library safe code. And this is going to be analogous to concepts like thread safe and asynchronous signal safe that have pretty formal definitions and that people have spent a lot of time thinking about and worrying about. But going further to what qualities does code have to actually need to be safe to use it as a library? So we'd like to make a formal definition, but it's actually pretty hard. The idea of making a formal definition that I've tried to do, and this is sort of an open project I'm still working on, is that you want to say if code fails to be library safe, if you're using it in two different programs, and you combine those two programs, and it breaks. And you know, if you know, people into you know, formal logic, you can think of some quantifiers over there and how you would express library safe in terms of that. But it's a lot more complicated than you know, the simplistic definition I've proposed right there. So I'm not going to worry about a formal definition right now. I'm going to say the basic idea is that we want library safe code to be usable by either an arbitrary application or by another library. And the second part is really the important part, without placing unreasonable restrictions on the application. As for the second part, why is it so important that it be usable by another library? Or why does that matter so much to the definition? Well, you can think about some limitations on library code, about how it can be used. It might be reasonable to just document with the, if it's just one application. You say my library is installing a signal handler. Well, you document that, and then the application knows that signal is reserved for the library. You can't use it. There's lots of other cases like this. But the problem is, if your library has limitations like that, any other library that uses it has to incorporate those limitations and document them as part of its requirements for the application using it. So as soon as your library has some requirements and restrictions on what the application can do, another library does, and all of these get used together in one library, by then you've piled up lots of requirements that might be hard for the application to meet. And perhaps more importantly, you've made the fact that one library is using another and this other one has requirements on what the application can do, you've made that a part of the interface contract of the other one. And that's really problematic from the idea of, you know, libraries just being something like a black box that's encapsulated and you can plug it into a program. So to start off, if code's not thread safe, if it, you know, blows up when you run it in a multi-threaded program, that's a showstopper. It means you, even if you weren't going to use it in multi-threaded context, it means you've got problems that make it not really suitable for use as a library. But the idea of library safe, I'm looking at, is actually going to be a stronger requirement than just being thread safe. So let's look at some of the issues that come up. Lack of thread safety. If you programmed with threads or in, you know, concurrent environments, you're probably familiar with, you know, race conditions. This is a little bit more subtle, but there's certain standard library functions that are just considered non-thread safe, and you're not allowed to use them in multi-threaded programs. So you've got a library that's using them that's problematic. And of course, unsynchronized access to global data. If your library has some kind of global dictionary or table or something and you don't have any locking around it, that's problematic. A lot of these top, you know, 3 points are pretty obvious, but I want to look at a special case that really occurs almost all the time in major free and open source libraries, and it's problematic for actually using them in a robust way. And that's this requirement that before you use the library, you call some initialization routine. And you can think of something that's maybe doing mathematical functions and needs to set up some global constant tables. You can think of, well, I'll hold off on that because I've got some examples on the next slide. So the general pattern is some code that looks like this. You have a static variable that, you know, tells whether the library's been initialized yet, and you have an initialization function that the program has to call before it can do anything. Checks if it's done, if not, it sets the flag and then does the initialization work. Well, the problem is that, you know, this isn't thread safe to begin with. You know, it's called from two places at once. You have completely undefined behavior because it's not synchronized. But even if you did have a CPU that automatically, you know, partly synchronizes, that there's still race conditions where it might.
The library has its own page of global data that is shared between users of the
library? No, this is, so each process has its own complete independent memory state on Linux. It's not like Windows where you do have, you know,
yeah, last shared memory. That was OS 2.
But the situation, so what you might think is, this doesn't look like a really big problem if it's just the application calling the library. You just document the application, it's the first thing it does, has to call this. You put it at the beginning of main, and you're sure there's not another thread running, and everything's good. But then we have to look at, what's the situation if another library is using your library? Well, it can have its own initialization function and document that, you know, that has to be called at the beginning of main, and then its initialization function calls this one, and you're all good, right? Well, the problem then happens if you have two different libraries now that both want to use this library, and now they're both going to be not loaded, not linked when the program's linked, but loaded dynamically at runtime. Now, what if the program's loading these two libraries that use this dynamically at runtime, and both of the loads happen in separate threads in the same program? Now you've got the risk of this getting run twice at the same time. And there's no way around it. Now, the frustrating thing is, you know, POSIX threads actually has a canonical solution for this problem. It's a function called pthread_once that does exactly this, but does it in a thread-safe way. But unfortunately, no one uses it. Of course, you can also do this with just, you know, your basic blocks of whatever types and make it thread-safe. Now here, what are, you know, some of the major offending libraries here? Well, I was involved with mPlayer and FFmpeg way back for some years, and so I don't feel too bad about picking on them because I was probably responsible for some of the problems then too. But in order to use the libraries like AV Codec at all, you have to call a global registration function before you can access any codecs. And there's no thread safety whatsoever in that. So this is frustrating because this is code you'd really like to use in a library in a very generic way. An example I'd like to make is, let's say I want to make a library that makes thumbnails for displaying either, in a web interface or in your file browser, anything like that. It does image formats, thumbnails for videos, all sorts of stuff like that. I'd like to just use, AV Codec in a very general way so I can make thumbnails for movies too. But due to these problems, I have to then ensure that the calling application is able to make that safe. And that's a hard thing to do. So if I depend on these, my library is hard to use in a robust and safe way. It might end up having race conditions that are like a crash. Another offender is libxml2, which has a lot of problems as well. And I bring this one up because I did a reverse dependency search on Debian and about 300 other libraries. That's after I filtered out for duplicates, different versions, packages that don't really matter, all depend on this. So it's a pretty big deal. And it's got an initialization function that's completely non-thread safe. The real irony of it is the initialization function checks to see if you're using threads and sets up thread safety for the rest of the library, but it's not thread safe in itself. So, I had a few more things to go over here. Any code that doesn't have a way for the caller to have its own context, and there's so even in a single-threaded program, you might have more than one component using the library. And if the state or input of that library comes in the form of a global variable, you're in trouble because multiple parts of the program can't use it independently. And lots of these are pretty obvious. If you put the argument to your function instead of passing it to the function, if you put that in a global variable, it's going to be ugly for people to use it as a library. But what happens in a lot more subtle cases is that you've got some sort of global configuration for the library that the author of the library thought, this is global for the program. It doesn't need to be local to each caller. And in many cases, that's right in concept, but it's hard to use correctly. So a couple examples here are error handling functions and logging functions. Again, ffmpeg, libav. They have a nice function. You set up a log handler, and whenever there's errors in the bitstream it's decoding or stuff like that, it can pass log messages back. And the idea of this is if you've got a console application, you probably just want it to go to standard error. If you've got some GUI movie player, you might want it to either pop up a message, or more likely just go into a log window that people don't see unless they pop up this log window. Or you might want to just suppress the output entirely. But the problem is, because this has to be set up by the caller, you run into a problem if the application itself isn't using these libraries, but they're being used indirectly through another library. Again, like my thumbnailing library example. If I was doing that, the caller probably doesn't want AV Codec throwing all kinds of junk to the program standard error that'll show up on the console. It probably wants it to go somewhere else or just even suppress all this output, most likely. But the calling application, if it's using my thumbnail library, shouldn't even have to be aware that AV Codec's in use at all. That should be an internal detail. And we can't do that because of because this is a global setting here. Another example is glib, which is going to be another big example of issues as we go on. In glib, and I'm going to get to this in a little bit, it aborts the program if allocating memory fails. And now I'm going to get into why that's possibly problematic in just a little bit. But there's a way to work around this by setting up your own back-end functions for the allocators that somehow avoid failing. And this probably involves horrible hacks with long jump that nobody wants to hear about. But I mention it because it's another case where there's some global setting for the library. In this case, what backend functions you're going to use for allocation that really should depend on who's calling it, not be global. So we've got a few more things. I'm just going to run through these because we don't have time to go into this all in detail. Other example is leaking file descriptors. That means if you've got a program, say it's forking a child process and running an external program, the issue that's going on here is, I'll use the example from gcrypt here, it's opened a file descriptor to the urandom device to get entropy for cryptographic use. That's a perfectly reasonable thing to do, but the calling application has no idea that file descriptor is open or what the file descriptor number is. So it has no way of closing that before running an external program. And that means every time it runs an external program, that external program gets a copy of this file descriptor to the urandom device that it didn't want. That can lead to running out of file descriptors, or depending on what this is, you know, here it's not a bad thing, it's just the urandom device. But if that was to some piece of privileged information, it could actually end up resulting in security vulnerabilities. And there are ways you can work around this. It's basically a matter of using the close on exec flag, which was not possible to do safely and atomically until recently, but there are ways to do it now. I'm not going to get into this, but it's, you know, something, if anyone's got questions about it, you can ask me afterwards or during lunch. Now, what about libraries that clobber the application state? Changing the locale out from under you, that can be really annoying. Say you've got a program where you don't want your locale. Maybe you want the character set to be set so that it can use UTF-8. That's pretty reasonable. But maybe you don't want the numeric part of the locale change because you want to parse numbers using the period as the decimal point, and your user's locale happens to have the decimal separator being a comma instead. So libraries that change the locale out from under you are really problematic, especially in that changing the locale except at program startup is dangerous because it's not thread safe. Well, the major offender, GTK. There are other libraries that do this too, I believe. And I believe actually glib used to as well, but they removed it. Setting up signal handlers. Sometimes you need to, like if the whole point of your library is to handle seg faults and do backtraces or something like that. But in general, you know, that needs to be documented because there's only finitely many signals, and if one library doesn't know which signals the other's using, you're in trouble. Random number generator state. This is a little bit more subtle, but if the main program is trying to have reproducible results by setting the same seed for a random number generator every time, and the library calls that without the main program knowing, you're no longer going to have reproducible results. Now I want to get into probably what the biggest issues are. Ways that a library can abort or crash the calling program. And that's probably the most annoying thing. You know, if you're using some library, and that's actually what I, you know, based the name of this talk on, the idea, you're using a library and all of a sudden your program starts crashing because of something the library did that's outside of your control. So the typical causes, one, this is obvious, this is just programming errors breaking interface contracts, either using the standard library or other third-party libraries in the wrong way, or promising something to the caller and not meeting that promise. For instance, returning null when your interface contract says you're always going to return a valid pointer. Now, unbounded stack usage. This is a big problem. Lots of people who are new to C and really hate manual memory management with malloc and free learn about this function called Alloca. It's non-standard, but GCC provides pretty much all legacy Unix systems provided it. And what it does is it lets you make allocations on the stack that go away as soon as your function returns, which sounds like a lot of fun. So you don't have to worry about freeing your memory. But if you spend a little bit of time thinking about this, you wonder, well, what happens if Alloca fails to allocate something, or does it return null? Well, no, it doesn't. It just blows up your stack and starts either crashing or clobbering other data if you go over the limit. What's the limit? Well, you can't know. So you can't really use Alloca safely.
You can with ULimit. It defaults to 8 megs. It's not that big.
Well, yeah, that's not that big. You can adjust it. But the problem is if you're writing library code, you generally don't have control over the resource limits. That's generally something the main program set up. And the main program might be running your code in a thread other than the main thread, where it's either used a different default stack size or set its own stack size. So, and of course, then it's also possible that the main program has already used most of the stack when it's calling your code. So you really need to be a little bit careful if you're writing code that's going to be useful in general purpose about how much stack space it uses. And the biggest problem here is I didn't say any usage of Alloca, although I generally think any usage of it is a bad idea, but unbounded. So if you're just using the length of another string or some argument n that you got and passing that to Alloca without any idea how big it is, you're going to crash. And 9 times out of 10, it's actually a security vulnerability too. So, next one, failure to check the return value of functions that can fail. And I went on. So this one, the biggest example is malloc, but there's lots of other things too. For instance, if you try to read some data and don't check whether the read actually succeeded, you might have random junk in a buffer and then return that as though it was valid data and crash the caller. So there's lots of ways you can, failure to check return values can lead to crashing. That most of that falls under breaking the interface contracts. The big one at the end is intentionally aborting the program when something fails, rather than giving the caller a chance to handle this. And of course, the biggest example is when malloc fails, when you fail to allocate memory. I'm going to go into a lot more detail on this in just a second. But first, I want to cite some major offenders. Glibc has cases of unbounded Alloca usage. It has quite a bit of intentionally aborting when something fails without giving you a way to handle the failure. Glib, same thing. It aborts when allocation fails, and probably has several of these others, but I haven't looked into it a lot. And another one that gets cited a lot that I like to mention is the GNU multi-precision library, which is a arbitrary precision mathematical library. It's highly optimized, it's cited for many purposes, is sort of the best in its class. But unfortunately, it's not usable when either you might be under resource limits or when you don't know anything about the size of your inputs. So for instance, if you were writing a library, or even just directly using it, if you're writing maybe a database server, and once you want to be able to store arbitrary precision numbers in it. Well, as soon as someone sends you a giant number, GMP happily tries to allocate space for that, finds out it can't, and crashes your database server, which is probably not what you wanted. So where does a lot of this problem come from? Most of these cases of aborting the calling program without giving you a chance to handle failure are about handling what we like to call OOM, which is out of memory conditions. And so a lot of this stems from the myth that malloc never returns null on Linux. And this is because of, I think this myth comes from a naive understanding of what's either a bug or feature called overcommit in Linux. And I'm not going to go into a lot of whether it's a good feature or a bad feature, or whether you like it or don't like it. Personally, I prefer turning overcommit off. but I know there are people who love it, especially for certain types of applications and language runtimes. So I just want to go into some details in a second on why it's even, whether you like overcommit or not, whether you turn it on or leave it off, whether you even know what it is or don't, the myth that malloc never returns null is not true. Anyway, the common behaviors that come out of this is if programs assume that it never returns null, maybe they even never check the return value at all, and then they just rely on the kernel to crash when you dereference a null pointer. Well, relying on the kernel there is actually a pretty bad idea, because if instead of just dereferencing right at the pointer, you dereference with some big offset in it, you might actually access some other valid memory and start clobbering something else in the program. So the second option, you know, if you're not going to handle failure, you know, calling abort is at least a little bit better, but it's not good behavior for a library because it doesn't give the program any way to handle that. We're going to see in a second why that matters. So why can malloc fail? Well, if you're on a 32-bit system, your virtual address space is only 3 gigs, and that's not very big. You might have 4 gigs, 16 gigs of RAM, and a bunch of swap too. So whether or not you have, you know, you run out of physical memory, you just run out of addresses to give out. That's what happens first.
Mm-hmm. And it's not just consumed by malloc, it's consumed by mmap and a bunch of other things.
Exactly. So if you're mapping, you know, a large mmapped file, either manually or from loading shared libraries, things like that into your process, you'll use up the 3 gigs quick. And it can also, of course, get fragmented. So even if you're not using all that, it can be impossible to get a large chunk, say maybe even just a 200 meg chunk might be hard to find. So it can return null even on a system that's, you know, where people think, oh, malloc never returns null because I've got overcommit on it, or I've got 500 gigs of swap, so it should never, by the way, that's a really bad idea. It's gonna bog down your system and you're gonna have to reboot anyway. So another reason it could fail is if you've got resource usage policies, like you limit from the shell, in effect. If you want to, and this goes back to my example of, you know, the file manager bogging down the system when I tried to navigate to that giant image file. It would be nice if we could use these kind of resource limits to say, oh, I don't want this one program to ever use more than 50 megs, or I don't want this one program to use more than 200 megs. But you can't do that because so many libraries just crash the program when malloc fails, rather than backing out what they were doing. Another way it can happen is if you pass a really huge argument to malloc. So think about a 64-bit system, and maybe you're trying to load some file. It's got invalid headers in it. It's maybe says this is a, you know, 8 billion by 8 billion JPEG file, and you try to allocate a buffer for that. Well, you could just check and make sure the sizes make sense beforehand. But the problem is nobody wants to put arbitrary limits on it. They say, oh no, arbitrary limits, that's bad. So what it ends up being malloc that does the final check to make sure the limits you got from the network or files or stuff like that actually make sense. Say you've got a file that says, I've got 10 billion entries in me. Well, maybe the file doesn't, maybe it does. You can't load it on your system, most likely. So even if you've got huge amounts of swap or overcommit, malloc's still going to tell you you can't do that, especially if you're on a 32-bit system where it wouldn't even fit in the virtual address space. And then the last reason, if you're like me and you turn overcommit off, Linux is going to make sure every allocation can actually fit in some physical memory or swap and stop giving out memory when it can't. So why does this all matter? Well, I want to go back to some of the motivations. Sometimes you've got software that has to survive even if you've got an out-of-memory condition. This could be core system components, things like your init process or systemd, stuff like that. I believe systemd, I've been told this by someone and I haven't verified it myself, but I've been told systemd actually went to the trouble of pulling out and replacing some stuff from glib rather than using glib so it could avoid crashing when malloc fails. And then, of course, hard embedded in real time. You know, you don't want your pacemaker to crash when its, you know, logs fill up. So, second, software whose data must survive out of memory. And this is a much bigger class. You know, there might not be anything your word processor or web browser or something can do when it runs out of memory. But say you've typed 10 pages of new content on a paper you're writing or a blog or something like that. When it runs out of memory, you don't want it to crash and lose all your work. You want the calling program to be able to find out that this library wasn't able to get memory so it can do some kind of emergency save or something to keep you from losing your work. And so this is probably in many ways the biggest point on here. If your library is aborting the program when it fails to allocate, someone's going to get really mad that their work got lost.
Case that reminds me of, there was a few years ago where a buggy beta file system was causing crashes, and people found out that a bunch of their code was not keeping a complete copy. Mm-hmm. But doing a simple truncate and then rewrite. And if it crashed while it truncated before it rewrote the data, boom, the config file just disappeared.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, if we want, you know, a high quality system that's, you know, not just halfway decent, but the best, you know, this needs to be something applications can deal with. So I got the next one here, software that deals with abusively large inputs. That's basically anything that's, you know, getting input from untrusted files or the network and so on. If you're allocating buffer space based on some number that came from you from an untrusted source, it could be large just intentionally to try to get your application, your daemon, to crash. And you don't want that to happen.
Yeah, the point you were making earlier about navigating to the large JPEG and then the system thrashing itself to death, and it was pinned by that. Part of the point it looks like you're using with ulimits and stuff is that because it doesn't handle out of memory properly, we can't impose limits on top
exactly.
of it to prevent it from going into swap thrashing because you gave it 500 megs of swap.
Exactly, that is exactly the problem here. And so then I'm kind of mentioning that here. Some software that runs under constrained resource limits. That could be ulimit, could be, I haven't studied it yet, but apparently Linux containers have some much better new ways to manage resource limits for processes or groups of processes that look really promising, but we're going to have these same issues. And this all comes back into, you know, building a new mobile system. You know, here we're dealing with, you know, people running applications that came from all different sources that might not be very high quality individually. And so we're definitely going to be wanting to impose resource limits, do some kind of virtualization, sandboxing, and so forth. And if everything's crashing as soon as you try to limit it, you're in trouble. So what are some of the obstacles to getting there? Well, the first one is getting stuff done. And this one's pretty simple. A lot of people writing libraries, when they sit down to write a library, they're not thinking, how am I going to make this library, you know, behave really well so that it improves the quality of Linux systems as a whole? They're thinking, I want to get something done. And, you know, I've got a cool idea, something new I want to implement. And, you know, spending a lot of time on making the best implementation quality can be contrary to progress. And that, I think, is a big example. I could come up with lots of, you know, mainstream examples, but instead I want to, if I can get my network access working here and show you something, I want to show you a project I'm excited about called libfirm. And this is, it's basically like a much lighter, simpler, possibly better designed version of what LLVM is. It's a compiler framework. It's written entirely in C, and the people working on it are really cool, but it hasn't gotten anywhere near the attention it should. So if you get a chance later, you know, Google for libfirm, that will find it very easily. And one of the fun parts is that you can try it and look at the assembly language it outputs for different code right in the browser. It's got an interface, you know, where their server has a compiler on it, and you can look at what it generates, what code it generates for different C. So it's kind of fun. And already, it's not mature yet, but there's already a lot of things it generates better code for than GCC does. So I'm excited about it. But on the flip side, why I brought this up as an example is that it's a great compiler framework, but it's not great yet as a library. There's lots of issues of using global state. For instance, it's so far going to be problematic if you wanted to use it, say, as a just-in-time compiler and have multiple instances of it in the same process. To do something like that right now, I think you'd have to fork multiple processes so they could be independent. And that, you know, is the type of limitation that, you know, this talk is all about trying to eliminate. Anyway, one final note on that. Even if it does have lots of global state, it's still nowhere near as bad as GCC in terms of global state, so. Second obstacle is what we call cargo culting. And if you're not familiar with this phrase, the basic idea is cargo culting is copying a pattern you've seen somewhere else with the idea that you're going to get the same or similar effects, but without any understanding of why it was done. And it comes from a famous lecture given by Richard Feynman, which if you've got some time, you should Google and read, because it's an amazing lecture by, you know, one of the great minds of the 20th century. But this is, you know, the abort when malloc fails is, you know, the canonical example of this. People see programs that do that and they copy it. Well, for some programs this makes sense. If you're writing, you know, a simple one-off, you know, command line program that, you know, you give it a command line, it's supposed to do something, and if it can't proceed any further because it ran out of memory, it exits, then aborting when malloc fails is perfectly fine. But what happens is other people see that and copy it without understanding why it was fine for the original program but not fine for them. Now, the weakest link concept, and this one is why a lot of you might be thinking, you know, why does this talk matter? Well, the hard reality is that there's no immediate benefit to making your library better with regards to library safety or not crashing or not aborting the program, because the whole situation for a program is no better than the worst library it's using. So if a program's using 20 different libraries and one of them has problems that make the program crash, then you're not going to be able to fix that no matter how good your library is. And why is that bad? Well, I brought up the last one here, the sort of idea of hopelessness. Well, it's bad because one of the weak links is used in every single program. So this is one of the things that really keeps people from making their libraries better. This has been my experience. When I go to developers or maintainers whose libraries have problems with library safety, they say, well, you know, the program could crash from out of memory anyway because glibc could abort it or something like that. So why should it be better? I'm going to look at a few examples quickly of things it does wrong. This is thread local storage. This is part of the implementation in glibc of thread local storage. And you'll see a couple places here. These are actually not the most likely places where the out of memory function is going to get called, but there are some quick examples I pulled up. There's others in handling of thread local storage which are more likely to cause it to crash.
That's not just taking down one thread, that's taking out the whole process.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, so it takes out the whole process. And C, the way threads work, there's no way for just a single thread to crash. The whole process goes down. There is a way to ask a single thread to terminate itself gracefully, and that's called the pthread cancel interface. Now, glibc can also crash you in this. It's not as likely to happen, but the first time you try to cancel a thread, it dynamically opens the shared libgcc, which is for a bunch of arcane unwinding purposes that probably no one in here understands or wants to know about. But the point here is that if it can't load that library, it crashes the program.
Out of file handles.
Mm-hmm. Out of file handles, no virtual memory left to map it. There's all kinds of transient reasons this could happen. And instead of crashing the program, it could just return an error. Ptrace cancel has a return value. It can return failure, but it doesn't. It crashes the program. This could also be fixed by static linking libgcc into libpthread, which wasn't possible back when this code was first written, but actually nowadays it is, and I'm working on getting them to fix this. Here's a really nasty one. This is a bug I reported, and it's finally in the works to be fixed, but I think I'm not going to go into detail on it right now, though, because I'd like to get to more parts of the talk. If you want to see it later, there's a bug number here, and it's all on the tracker. Now, just another quick example. This one's more about failing to meet interface requirements. Anyone have a guess what this can do, where that string I'm passing there is, say, hello world, but the string is a length of exactly 1 base 2 gigabyte plus 1 byte. Any guesses what the output is? Keep in mind, we're trying to print a string that's gigantically long. I'll give you a hint, it's not going to be a gigantically long output. It just prints the first byte, and then the outer WPrintf, which is just printing how many bytes the first one printed, prints one. How about this one with it plus 5 bytes? Well, it prints the whole hello and prints a 5. Why does this happen? We've got some nice integer overflows here where the length of the string, once it's computed, is multiplied by 4, and it overflows. These examples, by the way, are in a 32-bit system because you couldn't make something large enough to make it overflow if you had 64 bits. So we've also got many cases of unchecked allocation that I mentioned earlier. These are in the process of being fixed, but it's a slow process. There have been a lot more in the past. And I guess that's what I want to say here on the bright side about glibc. These are in the process of being fixed. And the new maintainership of glibc is much more friendly, which I couldn't say before in the past. Easy to work with, and willing to fix these types of long-standing bugs. But it's a long process getting them fixed. Now I want to talk a little bit about Muscle, which is my own project. And specifically, I want to talk about how it can help with the issues we've been talking about so far. So what is it? It's a new implementation of the standard library, which is not just what you'd call libc. It also includes part of the math parts, which is traditionally libm, the threads implementation, the dynamic linker. Unlike glibc and others, it's MIT licensed. That's a permissive license. It means you can use it in a lot more places. It supports both static and dynamic linking. And the amount of per architecture assembly language code is really small. It can be as little as 300 lines, which means the behavior is uniform from one architecture to another, even from, say, between x86 and ARM or MIPS or all other types of architectures we might be interested in. And it can be used in place of any of the big ones. glibc, it's actually fairly ABI compatible with, which means you can run some applications and libraries that were already linked for glibc. Bionic, it doesn't have a compatibility with, but we're hoping that developers writing native code on Android will be interested in using this in place of Bionic. It gives you a much stronger native foundation, whereas Bionic's pretty much just written for running Java code or for running a JVM. And so how does it address library safety problems? Well, low memory and resource exhaustion conditions are never fatal. They're always detectable and reported. functions which otherwise wouldn't be able to fail except if they needlessly allocated memory dynamically don't do that allocation. They work with algorithms that don't need dynamic allocation. There are no late failures you can't recover from. That means it doesn't support lazy bindings. This is a dynamic linking feature where at load time things seem to work and then later you get a missing symbol error. And it doesn't do lazy thread local storage allocation. That's what I was showing in the first slide about glibc problems. It actually computes at last time it's possible to know and return an error whether there's going to be memory for satisfying your thread local needs. And if not, you get an error rather than a crash later. And I think here, that was the bug I skipped over on glibc's cancellation design, but we spent a lot of time in muscle development creating a new architecture for thread cancellation that's robust and safe and doesn't have race conditions like the slide I skipped over on glibc. And I'll quickly go through a couple more features here. Now what muscle can't do for you, it can't fix the rest of the library stack. So even if muscle lacks these library safety problems that glibc has, as long as you're still using all the same typical libraries that people use on Linux, it's not gonna fix problems in your application. But maybe our community can. And I want to see if I can pop up here. This is from our wiki, and we've got one page here that's bugs have been found during muscle development and reported upstream, and many of them fixed or in the process of being fixed. We've got a vibrant community that's interested in caring about these type of issues, and it's bringing them to the attention of maintainers of other packages and getting things fixed. And the reason I brought this up is just so you can see how long this list is. I think I counted about 52 of the newly reported bugs were in glibc. There's 99 other bugs and other things, including a number of bugs in the standards, like POSIX and the C standard, which we've been getting fixed. So that's, to me, exciting too. I don't know if it's exciting to other people. Let's see how I get back off of here. But so what muscle can do, it can provide a solid foundation if you're building a new system. For example, if you're building embedded systems that don't need a lot of other libraries, you can have a really solid foundation. And as a basis for new mobile platforms we're thinking about, it could be the beginning of a strong foundation. It can also provide an incentive to write solid libraries because now there's at least one system where the weakest link is no longer a libc. So we can go to developers and tell them, the only thing that's making it so programs that use your library crash is your library, and we want to solve this problem. And it's a lot, now that it is tractable for some Linux-based systems, it's a lot more interesting and feasible to get it solved. And last, providing examples of library safe code and techniques. And one thing I'm very happy about, code in muscle is very simple and for the most part uses really general techniques that lead to being library safe, not having problems with handling failure cases, allocation failures, and so forth. We do have a long way to go. And so I want to think about, if you found this topic interesting, ways to get involved. One is, with the muscle community, like I said, we've got a lot of people. Our IRC channel is typically about 50 to 60 people. A lot of them are idle, but we still do have a lot of active people who are working on detecting these type of issues, reporting things upstream, and improving the quality of muscle, which I should say right now is approaching the 1.0 release. We're planning to have muscle 1.0 sometime in the next month. So they're helping me iron out remaining bugs in muscle, which we won't get rid of all of them, but we've gotten rid of all the ones that are major design issues, and we've just got small things. If you do want to get involved with our community, our IRC channel is on Freenode. It's just Muscle, M-U-S-L. Second, getting involved in fixing things with glibc. They have, you know, now an interest in fixing issues like this, which is exciting, but limited resources. So, you know, anyone wants to have something that affects lots of Linux users, especially on existing desktop systems, that would be an awesome way to get involved and started. And just reporting and fixing bugs in other libraries. And as far as that goes, I want to talk just a little bit about diplomacy. Nobody wants to be told that their software's broken, that it sucks, and so on. When you hear that, your mind closes and you don't want to listen to what someone's saying. So, you know, today I picked on a couple pieces of software that I, you know, sort of, you know, picked on or complained about, and hopefully, you know, they're big enough projects that, you know, they're used to getting complaints and not too upset about it. But you especially don't want to, you know, give someone who's, you know, just getting started, someone new in the free and open source software, you know, the attitude that you think their software's junk just because it's got a problem in it. Nobody wants to have their language skills policed. And I kind of use language skills with two meanings here. You know, think of how annoying it is, you know, when people complain about your grammar or spelling or something like that. Well, computer languages are the same. It's annoying when people complain about your use of computer language and programming. So library safe, this new concept I've been working on, should be something about building a social contract for better software, not just about going out and policing software and saying, you're doing the wrong thing, you're doing the wrong thing, you're doing the wrong thing, and you need to change. And, you know, the important part of this is we're trying to build allies rather than, you know, just fuss at people until they break down and change things. Because to win, we need allies. You know, if we want to make Linux and the whole library stack better, we need everyone to be in on this and involved and excited about improving quality and being the best, not just changing things because we force them to. A few further tips. If you're making a bug report, patches always make the developers a lot more interested in following through with it. I say you want to go out of your way to make fixing the bug a win-win situation. If you're telling someone, you know, this isn't library safe and you should fix it this way, but fixing it that way actually makes things harder for them, makes it harder to maintain, or makes it harder for some of their usage cases, they're not going to like that. So, you know, when we fix things, we want to be in the position of improving things, or at least keeping the status quo for what the current uses are, and fixing problems. And I say, you know, this is where, you know, for me, Muscle came in a lot. You want to have an example of the code you've written or that you're planning to write or use that actually has practical problems from whatever, you know, issue the library has. If you're going to, you know, say, you know, your library is, you know, unreasonably aborting the program at this point, you have to have a usage case for, you know, why do you want to use this, but you're stuck not being able to use it because of this problem. So that's pretty much it for my talk today. Thank you all for coming, and a big thanks as well to the Muscle community who's, you know, made all this possible and, you know, turned what was, you know, my idea for a small project for a little libc to play with myself in 2005 into, you know, one of the, I would say one of the big three or big four libc choices for Linux that's, you know, gaining traction, has a big user base, has one of the most active channels on Freenode.
Question, about how many packages build against Muscle currently?
We've lost track now because it's so huge. It's one of our contributors who actually handles building cross-compilers that you can download and use immediately to try out Muscle for building binaries for different systems is also building the package config, which comes from one of the BSDs and has lots and lots of packages. And that's on our, it's linked from the main website on our wiki page where you can, you know, go and look at
order of magnitude, dozens, hundreds, thousands.
Thousands, possibly tens of thousands. So yeah, it's, you know, it's a lot, you know, there's other, you know, libc alternatives like Diet Libc that, you know, support hundreds of packages. Muscle's not like that. You know, this is intended to be usable for pretty much anything you can use glibc for, and if it's not, it's either, you know, typically for the reason of very small bugs in the package where it's doing something slightly non-portable that we can easily fix and send the patch upstream, or very small issues in muscle that usually will get fixed the same day you report them.
You said drop-in binary compatible replacement. Where are the corner cases where it's not going to be binary compatible?
That's not documented yet. So right now, using binaries that were linked with glibc and trying to run them with muscle is a very experimental feature still. There are cases that work. Most of the things that are keeping it from working in some cases right now are just little details where nobody's, you know, tried it yet. But there will be, in order for to get really, you know, robust support for that, there's going to have to be a couple compatibility layers added later on. That's going to happen after the 1.0 release, and that's, you know, going to be for a few interfaces where muscle does not have the exact same ABI or compatibility as glibc, mainly for reasons where we had to fix something that was essentially an interface bug in glibc. So,
Would you consider it stable enough to use for non-legacy code? Like, if you wanted to start a new project, is muscle ready for that, or you would just start?
Yeah, in fact, for starting new projects, you're going to have a lot better results, because pretty much if you run into trouble, what's going on is that you've got some really ancient legacy code that's assuming header A includes header B includes header C and pulls in some weird definition that, you know, wasn't really supposed to be there in the first place. That's the, you know, typical failure case that, you know, we still have. So in terms of, you know, using muscle, you know, if you're writing something that's intended to be distributed as a binary, either, you know, free software or, you know, non-free software, that's a great case for using muscle, because you can make something that's completely static linked and self-contained. You've got just a single file, someone copies it on their system, runs it, and it works, which is one of the big failings of Linux for, you know, distributing binaries up till now, all different, you know, versioning compatibilities and so forth. So, you know, that's definitely, you know, the intended usage case. If you're writing your software, you know, that's you're intending for people to download the source and you compile it themselves, then you shouldn't be writing to muscle. You should just be writing, you know, clean portable code, and then, you know, if user's running on a system that's built on muscle, they can compile it against that and it works. If they're running on, you know, any of the existing distributions that are built on glibc, they can build it on that, and as long as they don't run into, you know, one of the many bugs in glibc, it works.
Okay. Cool. Thanks.
Any other questions?
I have one. When you build muscle, you don't point it at existing kernel headers like you do with uclibc or glibc, and it doesn't suck a lot of defines out of the Linux kernel headers to tell you what version of, you know, 2.6 or 3. Whatever you're using. How does it know?
So all of the definitions that are you know, part of how the libc talks to the kernel are copied over into the architecture-specific headers in muscle. And there's a reason for doing that. It's basically twofold. One, the kernel headers are not reliable to be safely usable from user space, from version to version. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. And secondly, even if they are reliable, we have to worry about, you know, whether they expose additional things in the namespace that they shouldn't be exposing. And muscle's trying to provide a very clean POSIX and C conforming namespace where it doesn't throw a lot of extra stuff into the namespace, into, you know, the global namespace that you don't want. And so with the kernel headers, sometimes junk gets in there that shouldn't be there. glibc generally did the same thing way back 15 or more years ago. You know, and they're still using kernel headers for a few things, but for the most part, they have their own definitions. On the other hand, I think you're probably familiar with uclibc, which uses the kernel headers for everything.
Well, one of the weird things I did like 2 or 3 years ago is that PowerPC added a system call in a Linux kernel release that was available on other targets but hadn't been available on PowerPC.
Mm-hmm.
And thus, when I rebuilt UC libc against that, the binaries I made wouldn't run on older kernels because it had auto-detected the availability of a new system call and didn't have to emulate it with three fallback calls.
Yeah, generally, you know, the approach in MUSL is that we assume that the kernel is at least 2.6. There are many things that will work on 2.4, but it's not, you know, a supported and guaranteed to work target, and it definitely won't work for threads. So,
well, there's stuff that varies from target to target. Mm-hmm. For example, I was recently banging on the alpha guys because they never implemented UMount 2. Well, okay, they implemented it, they had the name wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing would use it. And now that they're fixing it, you can actually call it, although you could call it before if you just knew what the system call number was in the line.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming that...
Yeah, that's part of the benefit of copying this stuff into, you know, our own headers, is that even if the user doesn't have the latest kernel headers or whatever installed when they're building, all of the latest stuff gets supported because, you know, we've imported in the right definitions. And if it's things that might or might not be in the user's kernel at runtime, then we have fallbacks at runtime. So, you know, at least for the interfaces that are, widely needed. Things that are newly added interfaces and the old software isn't using, lots of the times we just, you know, it doesn't work if your kernel's too old to have the feature. Does that answer the question?
Yes.
Any other questions? Well, thank you again for attending my talk, and hope this was interesting to everyone.